Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. In today's episode, I want to share with you an interview I recorded some time ago with Daryl Holmes, who is the CEO and founder of 1300 Smiles. It's taken a while for this episode to go to air, and the reason for that is when we started recording the podcast, we're still experimenting with audio, and you know, as we've progressed with the podcast, our audio has improved. But this is one of the earlier recordings, and to be candid, I was never fully satisfied with the audio quality here. But having said that, the content that Daryl shares throughout this interview is really, really insightful. And he drops nugget after nugget of wisdom and gems all throughout the interview. So I think, you know, it's still really content rich. It's still really valid. And I hope you enjoy it. We cover heaps and heaps and heaps of territory in this particular interview. We talk about how 1300 Smiles came into being, about how Daryl first got started with dental practice, and equally, we talk about some of the things he's learned along the way, things that have worked really well for him, some of the things that, with the benefit of hindsight, he might have done differently. We also take a deep dive into some specific factors that have contributed not just the success of 1300 Smiles, but Daryl as a business owner and as business leader as well. We speak a lot about Daryl's ability to take action on a day-to-day basis, and he's very open when he says that some of the action and the things he put into place has not always been perfect, but the fact was that he was taking action every single day, and that takes a huge role in the success of 1300 Smiles and Daryl personally. We speak a lot about Daryl's mentors, what he's learned from each of them, some of the people who've been influential in his life, and we really dissect out some of those key lessons that are really useful, not just for 1300 Smiles, of course, but are directly applicable to anyone in the dental space. Remembering, of course, that 1300 Smiles was the first listed dental company in Australia. So he's got a lot of experience and he shares it very generously in this particular episode. We take a deep dive also into his role as a board member of the North Queensland Cowboys Leagues Club. And this interview was recorded not long after the North Queensland Cowboys won their first premiership last year. So we also dissect out some of the lessons that come up through sports and how they're applicable to business as well, and what he's been able to take into 1300 Smiles from his experience with the North Queensland Cowboys and apply it for great success. So I really hope you enjoy this interview. Daryl was extraordinarily generous in his insights and his commentary, and I hope you take some notes and enjoy it as much as I enjoyed recording it for you. So without any further ado, here's Daryl Holmes. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the show. It's an absolute pleasure to have Dr. Daryl Holmes with me here today. Daryl is the founder and MD of 1300 Smiles, and he's also the chairman of the Cowboys Leagues Club. G'day, Daryl. How are you going?
Great, Jesse. Great to be here today.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking the time out of your schedule. What I thought we'd have a talk about was a little bit about your journey and a little bit about the 1300 Smiles, you know, where you're up to with things. And again, a bit of a conversation about the future of dentistry and how things are traveling. Is that cool with you?
Great with me, Jesse.
Fantastic. Well, mate, there's probably not too many people who aren't familiar with 1300 Smiles these days, but for the person who might have been newer to the scene, could you give us a bit of an update on, you know, how 1300 Smiles came about, a little bit about your history and some of the lessons along the way?
Yeah, well, Jesse, it goes back a long way. We've been publicly listed on the ASX since the 11th of March 2005, so we've just had our 10-year anniversary of that. But the story goes well back to me graduating as a dentist at the University of Queensland with a scholarship for my final fourth and fifth years as a student there in Brisbane, and then being sent off to Adelaide to be, you know, do my officer training and various things, and obviously be a dentist in the RAF for the first 3 years of my dental career. And at the very end of that time, having been to Melbourne and Adelaide and overseas and all sorts of things, I had a great time in the RAF and it was a great opportunity and learnt some of the secrets and dynamics of working in a group practice, because most of the dental practices I was in, Adelaide, for example, had five or six dentists at the time, and most places I went had three, four, five dentists. So I got the idea of group practice and cross-referring and having others to support you in your day-to-day dental career. I finally ended up back in Townsville. Being away from Queensland was okay for 3-odd years, but being a through-and-through Queenslander, born and bred, I wear the maroon and with pride, and I wanted to get back there, and there's obviously Brisbane was full, Amberley and thereabouts. So I ended up in Townsville the first time in my life, and back in January 91, in the midst of a flood, funnily enough. And I then looked around locally, met, you know, some after-hours part-time practice in dentistry, and unfortunately, most of the older dentists that were here and long-termers said, no, we don't do any after-hours or evenings or Saturdays, and, you know, there's nothing available outside of my RAF dental hours. So I thought that was a bit strange, because there's obviously back then, 25 years ago, there was a lot of dental demand and a lot of people were booked 4, 6, 8 weeks ahead. So I sort of note to self thought, I think people actually want to be have more access and more availability of dental services. Hence, and then out of the blue, a local dentist, John Pulferenti, who worked actually in Eyre and Home Hill, which is an hour and a bit south of Townsville in the Burdekin, the biggest sugar production area in the country, which is obviously maybe good for teeth and dentistry. And the local orthodontic group who used to travel down there as one of their Ingham, Townsville and Charters Towers and the Burdekin suggested that he might be looking for someone to help out. I sat up with John within weeks and used to drive down Friday afternoon, work Friday evening and then sleep over with John and Peg at their house. Talk dentistry, talk life, and he was a great mentor to me in terms of he was, 10 or 15 years older than me, had been there, done that, had these two practices and several other dentists, and had learned a lot and been to all the courses, and it's just so important that ongoing CPD and, you know, business management and sort of marketing or just keeping your patients coming back, all those things that make a successful practice, and that is returning regular patients rather than the one-offs and the toothaches and those things. So we spoke a lot, we philosophized a lot, you know, I did a lot of dentistry, and before long he was sort of saying, well, you know, you knew my Air Force commitment was coming up in August that year, so it was literally January to August. I had the opportunity to get out and complete my return of service obligation. So he said, well, look, gee, I'd like to, you know, keep you on, and if you're happy to stay in North Queensland or Townsville or Burdekin, come and join me in partnership, and let's, you know, let's see what we can do with these two practices and think about Townsville and other places. So that's where it really all began. So we're in partnership then for 7-odd years. We expanded into Townsville in the early days then within 12 months, as well as building a brand new big surgery in the main street of Ayr. Again, profile and publicity and passing traffic, I think, is important. Putting, you know, patients' bums on seats, for want of a colloquialism. But yeah, getting people to know where you are and not be terrified of, you know, as some people are, of just even walking past or driving past the dentist. So we were right there in the middle of the main street, and it worked very, very well. We grew that. We had 4 chairs and a laboratory at the back. We just built and grew from there, then expanded into Townsville and brought up probably over the next 5 years, 6, 8, 10 of the older dentists who were, you know, near the end of their careers, didn't have much to sell because they were all most of those solo practitioners in a little old practice in the suburbs or on the house on the side of the main road, through one of the main roads in Townsville. And we built, basically went out there and built larger 5, 6, 7 chair facilities, brand new, often around a medical center or an allied health facility or within it, with high main road access and profile sort of thing, and, you know, brought those existing practitioners into the bigger, better, newer facility, and often 2 or 3 or 4 of them who might have worked in the same town for the last 10 or 20 years in their own little isolated cottage or little house practice, suddenly all became together in one big, bigger, newer, better, and where they could take holidays, where they could go off and work 3 or 4 days of the week or less or more. Some worked a week on, a week off. We gave them all sorts of flexibility, which gave them a huge, was a big attraction to them, because they were often quite sick of being on call, chased, demanded, and often back in those days having 4 or 6 week waiting lists. So But that's where it all began.
Well, look, that's fantastic. And there's a couple of really good gems in that already, Daryl, just in that story, because, you know, what's coming through very clearly is you knew your market very well. You knew that there was a pent-up demand for patients wanting, you know, out-of-hours appointments. And so you'd obviously put some thought into not just the market, but the strategy behind that. So, that, you know, for anyone listening there is a lot of thinking that goes on before, you know, just setting up, you know, just do a build it and they will come kind of mentality. I'm sure you'd agree with that, Daryl. There's a whole lot of strategy behind where you open and what goes into that.
Yeah, very much so, Jesse. And it was not that long after we started, during those early formulative years, where John and I would spend, you know, a day a month or at least half a day a month and at least a day a quarter every 6 months where we, you know, go off away from the practices and spend that time together and actually strategize and talk about the practices now that we had two in the Vertican and one and then two and then three. And literally every year there were several more facilities and buying more of the older dentists who was coming on board for, you know, to hand over their goodwill over the next year or two. And look, we developed along the way a AAA rating or policy. And that was A for accessibility. The second A being availability and three, of course, third A being affordability. And right there and then sums up what you're talking about. That's a strategy, and that is being available, accessible, and affordable to as many people as you can possibly be and provide, obviously, the best care to as many people as possible, because most people have a dental need, as we know. It's just whether or not they can get in to see you. Back then, with 2, 4, 6, 8 week waiting lists, that was a dreadful problem. So you had to expand your hours or expand your number of chairs or expand your number of dentists, etc. And these are all things that don't just happen overnight. You don't just wake up one day and build a new chair or a new surgery and you suddenly have, you know, a new dentist on your doorstep. Because back then, the biggest challenge by a country mile was attracting and recruiting and finding new dentists to work in these regional areas where the demand, being 6 week waiting lists, was so huge that it was just, you know, it was soul destroying as a dentist, because you could never look and say, oh, you know, take few days or a week off, you know, in a week or two's time, because their patients book, you have to reschedule a week or 2 weeks full of patients. So strategically, you had to look at all aspects of the business, as we still do now, to decide what's happening in 3 and 6 and 12 months and 2 and 3 and 5 years to figure out where you're going. Because a ship without a rudder and a navigational course or a GPS plotting is certainly going to get lost at sea, like a business.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the common threads that, you know, I know we've spoken about in the past as well is really charting a really solid course and knowing the milestones and the markers of the journey along the way. You know, if you're driving from Townsville to Brisbane, I'll use a good Queensland example. You know you're going to be going past Bundaberg. You know you're going to be going down past the Sunshine Coast and down into Brizzy. And if you don't know what those milestones and markers are, as you say, with your 2-year, 3-year, 5-year plans, then you could well end up in Perth.
Or Ayers Rock.
Or Ayers Rock, exactly. You probably get Ayers
Rock. Broken down somewhere in between.
Yeah, well, it's even worse, isn't it?
Lost.
Yeah, exactly. So it seems to me, Daryl, that there's been this guiding philosophy for you. You know, the AAA philosophy, I think, is absolutely beautiful. And one of the things that, again, that I'm hearing, and just to distill this, is that there's a concept that's very simple, but clearly it's not easy, right? Simple is not the same as easy.
True.
Yeah. So is that philosophy that you started off with, John, you know, has that basically still followed through with what you're doing now, or is it kind of evolved and matured, or what's the situation there?
John had a huge amount, and like I say, was a great mentor, and again, that's a key theme that I'll keep coming back to now and something I'm involved in now. Myself giving back in terms of the cowboys and young leaders in Townsville and North Queensland and various other things, but we'll touch on that later. But taking others' experiences and the courses, Ken James, trying to think of all the names back in the day of those practice management people, Jennifer D. St. George's, Linda Miles, all those we used to go to, Ray Bertolotti, Gordon Christensen, finding people who've been there, done that, or done all the research, or done the hard yards often, who've got great materials or techniques in marketing or recall systems or just customer service, all those things that are so critically important to a successful practice, you can never get enough of that stuff. So you just got to keep thinking strategically, implementing operationally those, you know, systems, procedures or techniques or methods to just keep hammering home success and results. And that is ongoing growth and care for your patients over the long term. We talk about the cradle to the grave. We like to see kids, you know, even below 2, just coming in with their mums and dads and just sitting there, and then obviously early into the chair and the 2, 3 as they get teeth and stuff, it just becomes a habit. And then we love, you know, I've got some 95-year-old patients who I still see and treat, and often they're coming in with their daughter or their granddaughter, and, you know, there's 3 and 4 generations either in the practice or in the room, the surgery with me on my still Wednesday mornings that I do my clinical practice still. And it's just such a pleasure to be able to, you know, treat obviously very differently, but provide that full range of services to people in their 90s as much as the people who are, you know, kids, babies who are 18 months to 2.5, 3 years of age for their first visit. So, yeah, that care strategy and then implementation of it and just consistency is a couple of key learnings as well.
Yeah, cool. Fabulous. So, Daryl, I guess there's obviously been a lot of things that have come up as you've gone through the journey that you've been on for 20-odd years. Looking back on that journey, are there things that with the benefit of hindsight, and of course, you know, the hindsight retrospectoscope is a luxury that none of us have, but you know, if you were to look back on that journey, are there any key points where you think I might have zigged when I zagged?
Yes and no. There's lots of little things. I'd like to answer that question in life generally, to think I live life with no regrets and no concerns. There is always going to be in any relationship or business or choices you make, always the old looking over the fence or the grass is a bit greener the other way or the other direction. Speed of things and, you know, whether you do things faster or slower, you know, there's always often a lot of stress related to, you know, high speed growth and development and getting on with things. But that's sort of my personality and my trait. I could have, you know, done things a lot more slowly and gently and methodically and, you know, ticked every box every step of the way and so on. But I don't think we would have listed, you know, 10 and a half years ago. And I think our growth and our process and progress would have been very, very different. So, yeah, look, you do things and on the fly or in retrospect, you think, oh, geez, I could have slowed down a bit or thought about that a bit more. But, you know, nothing's, the old saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I've never really been life-threatened. I thank the Lord for that. But, yeah, you make a lot of decisions on the fly and hopefully your gut instinct and your, you know, years of experience or, you know, weighing things up, 9 times out of 10 or 8 times out of 10, you make the right decision. And even if it's the wrong decision and you've identified or realize that, then it's often fairly speed to react or speed to act is a way to recover from it and make sure it's not terminal or financially or life or health or family or relationships killing sort of thing.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And one of the things that I really agree with you is I try not to spend too much time looking in the rearview mirror of life because you can send yourself crazy doing the, you know, coulda, shoulda, wouldas. But what I love about your philosophy, Daryl, is speed of implementation, you know, get it done. And one of my mentors used to say to me and still says to me, you know, Jesse, prolific beats perfect every single time. And
that's a great saying.
And I think there's a lot of truth in that, actually. And yeah, every time I'm taking too long to angst over something, I just have this little voice in my ear kind of doing the, you know, pull your finger out, mate, and get on with it.
What's the downside of a yes or a no?
Absolutely.
And it's one of my favorite sayings, life's full of choices or decisions, just make one.
Exactly.
And honestly, I think one of my philosophical comments is that society and people generally, including right from the top, from politicians and, you know, our leaders in business and other areas, but certainly politically and, you know, around town at all levels of government, and often it's the inability to make a decision.
Yeah.
Rightly or wrongly, it's a yes or no in most cases. So make it and live with it. And like you say, you know, make lots of decisions and then statistically you, unless you're a real goose, you're going to make a vast majority of them the right way or for the best benefit. And those you lose on, it's like lottery tickets and random things. You lose a few, but you win hopefully a lot more.
Yeah, exactly. And accumulate a lot of wisdom along the way.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, cool. So one of the things, Daryl, is, you know, in your position, obviously you get to see a lot of stuff that perhaps the average person on the street may or may not see or may not think about seeing. And what I'd really like to talk about is, you know, the state of dentistry. You know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, the biggest challenge back in the early 90s was getting, you know, practitioners to regional areas such as Townsville and North Queensland. Clearly, there's been a massive change in that department over the last 20 years. And I'd be interested in your reading of the tea leaves on, you know, what you think of the current state of the profession and, you know, where you think, you know, what the current trends are. If you were to look into your crystal ball, I don't know if yours is as cloudy as the rest of ours, but yeah, what would be your thoughts on what's coming down the pipeline?
A very interesting and topical question. I've been asked the crystal ball question several times in the last month or two, and in fact, I'm addressing an ADAQ seminar on it in the next month or so. I'm still trying to gather my full thoughts and pictures on it. I think we're still in a massive state of flux. I hear on the, you know, the news and stuff this morning that they're talking about a potential another GFC next year or something, and that's all terrible doom and gloom. You know, I don't think dentistry's out of the challenge and the turmoil of the last few years post-CDDS and the explosion of dental schools and graduates, including the overseas dentists. Of, you know, well over 1,000 dentists are commencing practice or coming into Australia annually at the moment. And my rough numbers are that that's, you know, 8, 9, 10% increase in the number of dentists. Unfortunately, a lot of dentists, the older dentists, aren't exiting as they used to because they're all staying on either part-time or full-time and topping up that super fund a little bit extra, topping up the nest egg, or they've been, you know, burnt by various decisions or rightly, wrongly, whatever. But again, making a choice, but maybe it wasn't the right one and it can have a significant financial effect. So there's just more dentists out there, and there's a far greater influence of health funds, private health insurance, which is obviously a big catch cry at the moment.
Mm.
The corporate world, obviously, we know that Bupa bought Dental Corp from left field, and I think that shocked a hell of a lot of dentists, and particularly the dentists who they bought. And they now, their boss is now Bupa, a health fund, which in general, I think there's a, you know, bit of an anti-health fund sentiment, rightly or wrongly, again. So they are having far more effect. Bupa's now rebranding and, you know, rolling out a Bupa dental brand. So for the first time ever, you know, a national brand of dental practices is happening, rightly or wrongly. To some extent, I think, you know, health insurers should stick to their knitting, just like dentists should broadly stick to their knitting and do what they know best. But again, that's very debatable topic for another day. Paying out, or what they're paying out to dentists, both in a preferred provider and just the non-preferred provider dentists, is very topical and very debatable because, yeah, there's, you know, various different levels that you can either commit to or not with a health fund, and it does financially affect you significantly. So independence, there is a price, and jumping into bed with them in terms of preferred provider contracts is a challenge and something that was so no-no and anti and smashed and bashed by the ADA and the profession 10, 15 years ago is now very much part of the core and the philosophy of a lot of practices and certainly a lot of the other corporates. Government funding of dentistry, well, there's some tea leaves that are very murky and a crystal ball that's very cloudy. As I said in my recent annual report, my letter to shareholders, the government really just does, on any level, state or federal, doesn't really understand dentistry, where it fits in the overall health system and scheme. And I don't think anyone seems to know what to do with it. It's sort of like the big elephant in the room. They're now acknowledging that, you know, preventing dental problems and a lot of gum disease and other problems dentally can affect, you know, hospitals and bed stays and the emergency departments, which is obviously a hot topic across all governments, particularly state governments, their health budgets and problems. So even now, I mean, apart from the CDBS, the Child Dental Benefit Scheme, with $1,000 over 2 years for healthcare card entitled kids and families, that's about it for dental funding of any significance compared to the heyday back in the CDDS when the government was, you know, throwing around again, I believe, far too big an amount of money, $4,250, to non-means-tested people with chronic illness. So that, as we know now very well, blew out dreadfully to over $1 billion a year. But it could easily have been trimmed and fixed by cutting the amount to $1,000 or $1,500 or maybe $2,000, even cutting it in half and making it means-tested. We wouldn't have thrown the baby out with the bathwater. But instead, we throw it all out. It's all been disbanded, basically, potentially never to be re-implemented because it's, you know, too hard and too expensive and everything else. When we could have cut the budget in half or a quarter, made it means-tested because that was a big argument for getting rid of it, and still have a fair safety net of private and the existing government provision of dental services to that broad 25 to 33% of the population who have a healthcare card and really an entitlement to dental care, not just toothaches and extractions. So where does the government play a role? That's part of the problem. And Veteran Affairs and so on, well, obviously that's reducing over time, I'd imagine, as a spend, because unfortunately a lot of those veterans and older entitled patients and wives are unfortunately passing away. So that's a thing that's diminishing with time, I believe, although, you know, the new military, ex-military people have some degree of DVA-type cover. Mm. You know, I think we've got to think outside the box, and that's what we've done recently with the dollar-a-day dental care plans and our $99 a week dental care vouchers. You know, different things. We've got to, I think, forget about the government, try and forget about private health insurance, but that's difficult because they now provide probably, you know, I'm not sure of the stats, but half to two-thirds of the dental funding model in this country. But there's still a vast majority of people who don't have health insurance and can't afford dental care. So, yeah, I think it's a tricky challenge. But somehow or other, we've got to break our dental services down into more affordable chunks and have payment plans and funding arrangements so that people can actually achieve that third of our AAA policy, and that is affordability, both from a pricing point of view, a delivery point of view, more efficient and effective delivery of services at a more reasonable price and in a way that people can afford to pay it and not be the Mount Everest they have to climb over to try and pay for their next crown or root filling or other treatment.
Yeah. So it's really interesting, Daryl. Clearly, there's a confluence of circumstances, obviously, at the moment. You know, we're almost caught in this, I sometimes refer to it as a perfect storm in a sense. There's this, you know, massive influx in terms of dentists. There's the increasing influence of the health insurance companies. And then, of course, you know, the relative inactivity of governments of all persuasions. And so we seem to be kind of entering a period of, I think, quite significant change, which, you know, no one knows, in my view, where we're going to quite end up. But I'd be interested in your philosophy on this, Daryl, because, you know, one of the things, like you, I have the opportunity to speak to lots and lots of people, and I think there's a proportion of dentists out there, and, you know, I say this with all care and kindness, who have a glasses half empty perspective, perhaps, on their future. But I would be thinking that you might have a glasses half full perspective and think, well, where there's uncertainty or where there's change, there's opportunity. That's certainly my take on it.
Yeah, and absolutely, Jesse. But threat and change certainly create opportunity. You've just got to take stock of it, figure it out and work out, then make a decision to grab that opportunity or innovate or do something a bit differently. And that is very challenging for people in general, and certainly for most dentists that I know. So it is the perfect storm is actually a phrase I use quite often as well. And I throw in around that is a tsunami, because I believe we've helped governments reduce their waiting lists, and that billion, you know, and up to $1 billion over 7 years from when Tony Abbott, the health minister, introduced the CDDS back in 07, right through to November 30th, 2012. Dates firmly etched in my mind. They were, you know, we were delivering a lot of dental care across the nation, rightly, wrongly, all of that aside, there was a lot of dentistry being done on a lot of people. So where we go with that and how we fund that, and the tsunami comment I make is that all those people had a lot of that care now 2 to 3 to 4 years ago, and a lot of them, apart from going on the waiting list and getting back into the government system, can't afford to have that maintenance and that ongoing treatment, which we as dentists know very well is necessary. It's just like, you know, they've all got a four-year-old car, but none of them have taken it in for oil or, you know, water or a checkup and a grease and oil change. And so that's, to me, a big tsunami of pent-up demand that's, you know, slowly moving across like a tsunami does. Not a tidal wave, but a tsunami where you sort of don't notice it. It just keeps coming in, and then when it hits land or somewhere, it goes crash and bang and floods and causes a lot of grief. So I think there's still a lot of pent-up demand. I don't think we as dentists, and I don't think the government, are acknowledging that and working out ways to cost effectively, and I don't mean cheaply, but cost effectively provide more dental services to more of the population in this country.
So, Daryl, just want to get your perspective on something for a moment. You know, obviously, there's a lot of people listening to the podcast who are not, you know, the MD of a corporation such as yourself. There'll be a lot of guys listening going, well, that's good. I'm in my own private practice, so on and so forth. If you were sitting in a private practice, in a traditional private practice in Australia at the moment, in whichever part of the country, where do you see the opportunities are for those guys? You know, obviously, you get to see all different business models, you get to see all different things working. What do you see is, you know, just looking at takeaways for the audience here, you know, what sort of insights would you offer those guys?
It's tricky because I don't think it's that rosy. Like you said before, I am a half full and filling up and trying to find a tap or a bottle to top it up more sort of person. Apart from the long-term established practices who've been there, you know, 10, 20 years, like you and I have been out of uni and longer than 30 and 40 years, well, they don't have a problem. They've got a massive database of patients. If they've been doing a good job in delivering great customer care or patient care at a, you know, really any price, because if you've been there 10, 20, 30 years, you've got a huge database and recall list and just repeat patients coming back for various reasons. Running a good, effective recall system is obviously really critical to keep people coming back. It is just such bread and butter and essential component of a business.
If there was one thing, Daryl, that I say to the guys I work with is get your recall system locked down, because that is, to me, the engine of your practice.
Yeah, and that's your cake mix, and the oven is, you know, the rest. If you don't have that in the core and the guts of your business or your practice, then you're going nowhere over, you know, the foreseeable future. Hand in hand in that is if you've only been in practice 1 or 2 or 3 or 5 years, you just don't have enough of that, you know, cake mix or bread mix to go in the oven to keep your practice growing and developing. So that's a double-edged sword and very tricky. So there's sort of multiple different factors here. But if you've got a large database or you've bought a fairly large, you know, database of patients in a practice, then hopefully, you know, obviously great customer service hand in hand with great communication, it's a key to it all, as well as obviously doing good clinical dentistry after the patient's got, if you built that trust and rapport and got the message that, or got to yes, as we have a saying internally, getting to yes, you've got to get the patient nodding and agreeing and liking you and being affirmative rather than no, to treatment options and liking you, no, and, you know, the cost, no. If you can get to yes, you get patients liking, understanding. We talk about educating to motivate people to say yes and get to, you know, accepting some of a treatment plan. We also always talk about giving them three options: do nothing, do sort of everything, the Rolls-Royce treatment plan, but certainly, most importantly, get them to saying yes to something in terms of a second visit or a third visit, just to start, you know, getting used to coming back and overcoming some of the fears and concerns. And we also talk about the fear of pain, of course, which I think is largely, has to be, almost eliminated in dental practice these days with techniques and understanding of it. But the fear, the second biggest fear is, of course, fear of cost and the fear of the, as I call it, the hip pocket nerve. And that is, how much is it going to cost? And we've got to be open up front talking about how much certain options and someone are going to cost so that people can make an informed decision about how to pay it off. And again, I touched on before, they've got to have some options in terms of payments, be it health funds, credit cards, bank accounts, loans, you know, dental treatment plans and progressive payments, direct debits or whatever, because they are so critically important to people being able to say yes and afford whatever it is you're trying to offer them. Not just doing everything cheap, but, you know, more efficiently, more cost effectively, you know, electronic and digital and, you know, all sorts of other laboratory and prosthetic ways of making things and milling and printing processes, etc. You know, they're ways to do dentistry more effectively, efficiently and profitably. So, you know, there's a lot in that whole space of how to deliver it cost effectively and so on. So back to the suburban practice, all of that, but I still, one of my core philosophies and views on the world to where we started and what our view is on a dental practice is that it's ideally 3 or 4 or 5 chairs, you know, ideally 5 or 6 in my view, really, with several dentists, hygienists and whatever, mixing up lifestyles and, you know, sea changes and however many hours and however much work you want to do in a shared expense sort of basis. And that's sort of what we provide is, you know, fully equipped dental surgeries for dentists to, you know, operate their own practice in and do as much or as little within reason, you know, during their week or their month. We have dentists who do a week on, a week off. We have every second week they have off, or they have a 4-day weekend every second or third week, or they work 4 days a week or 3 days a week. So people have to think about their lifestyle during their working years and not just rushing into retirement and thinking, oh, you know, work 30 or 40 years, then retire. And then, unfortunately, there's a huge syndrome of dropping dead 6 or 12 months after that point.
There absolutely is, and that's tragic when you see that happening. So, look, mate, there's some really good points, and what I'd really like to say is clearly, as you've gone through your whole growth and expansion process, again, I just want to segue into the team that you've built around you as well, because, you know, as successful as you've been individually, clearly you've had some good guidance and mentors, and obviously the support team you've built at 1300 as well. Could you just give me some insights on, firstly, the role that you've mentioned John Pulvarenti, of course, but, you know, some of the roles the other mentors might have helped you with, or, you know, some of the guidance they might have given you, or, you know, good pearls of wisdom that have come through there. And secondly, the importance of the team that you've built at 1300 and how you went about building that.
Yeah, great questions, Jesse. And off the cuff, there's a lot to it. So how to answer that quickly off the cuff. I've had a few mentors, not tons. And we touched on John and various others, a couple of other business guys, a couple of investment people. I'm a gatherer of information and views on things, and then I cogitate and ruminate and think about it, and then I make a decision, as we touched on, and then I act on it very quickly or 100% committedly sort of thing. So, yeah, I've had lots of input from lots of different people, and even, you know, today and 2 hours ago, I'm meeting and discussing business and investments and various things and opportunities, and, you know, I listen to and read whatever information's been provided and then kick it around or ask a few questions and then, yep, no, yes, yes, no, yes, let's do it, let's not, and get on with it. So you need to build, I think, people around you, obviously, you build a team dentally and here at head office and whatever that aren't all sycophants or yes, yes people, but actually different people. And that is a big challenge, to work to your strengths and weaknesses. It's like the great words of Henry Ford saying, you know, how do you produce so many thousand motor cars and how have you built such a big empire? And he said, I employ a lot of smart people around me. And it's very true. Just to plagiarize his words, you've got to build people who are in our business, who are good in accounting and financial and, you know, accountant types who are just into the details and into all the technicalities of accounting and finance. And you've got to build people in HR who are all the bubbly and, you know, touchy-feely. And, you know, we do DISC profiling. We do various other leadership profiling and other things with our management staff and dentists to some extent and so on. So you've got to, you know, play to your strengths and hopefully delegate. You know, we talk about internally more of, less of things to do each day. So do more of whatever these things are that are high value and, you know, well worthwhile compared to doing less of, you know, the crappy run-of-the-mill time wasting things. And different people love to do different things. So if you can find a team of people to build around you that love doing whatever it might be, IT, technology, well, you know, some people love it. Some people look at a damn machine, and if it doesn't work and you can't send your email or it's got a black dot, you know, in the middle of it or something, you just go, it's like someone sticks a knife in you and there's just no way. You turn it on and off and then you ring someone. So different people love or hate different aspects. So if you can get a team around you that love to do things that you don't love to do and are good at things that you may not be so good at, or can teach you or help you or manage those things. And another key to it is then to be able to delegate.
Ah.
And I think from experience, a lot of dentists are more controlling and it's, you know, sort of obsessive compulsive or very focused on very micro things, which makes a good dentist. But to be able to delegate adequately and well and hold people accountable and responsible for those things and then ensure they're delivered in a timely and efficient manner, then that's gold, and that's certainly a key to my success, trying to delegate as much as I can, get help and input from others and trust them. As they build that trust, you'll just get a lot more done in a day and be far more successful. And hopefully, touching on work-life balance, hopefully you're not, you know, tied up all day long in your practice or in your office, and you can spend some time every day exercising, you know, doing something, you know, spiritual, or, you know, yoga to Christianity to the Bible to whatever you rows your boat, as well as, you know, relationship, family and children, as well as obviously business, as well as dentistry and any of those other fun things you want to do, hobbies and sports and activities. So getting a bit of all those things in each day, or certainly each week, is really critical to building the team and building your life, and not rushing, like I touched on before, headlong into retirement, but actually enjoying every day, booking your holidays, thinking about where you want to go, booking them so you've got goals and milestones throughout the year to be off snow skiing, water skiing, bushwalking, or lying on the beach, whatever it is you like to do, but scheduling all that stuff in and then working towards it, having a team that can manage and help manage you achieve those things is so critical.
There's so much gold in that, Daryl. That 5 minutes of just on team there, for anyone listening there, that is HR distilled down to, I think, the absolute core nuggets of gold there. And just to recap this, because I just want to make sure we capture some of this and really lock it in there, because you really hit on a couple of really big themes there, Daryl. One was hiring really good people, you know, Henry Ford saying, you know, hiring smart people, which is fantastic, having them play to their natural strengths and abilities. And, you know, one of the things I constantly see is, and you might have seen in the past too, is, you know, when you're doing performance reviews, we're often focusing on, yeah, you need to improve this, but that's not what they're naturally good at. So you've got to put in a position that does play to their natural strengths. It'd be like having Jonathan Thurston, who we'll come to shortly. It's like putting him in the prop position. Yeah, we're not playing to his natural strengths and abilities. The ability to delegate, critical, as you said, letting go of some of those things and having the trust in the people that you delegate to. Well, what I really liked was you doing more of this and less of that, in that 80-20 rule, you know, focusing on those key things, the high-value things that really drive the performance of your practice. And for anyone listening there, that is 24 karat gold there, Daryl. So thanks, mate. That's wonderful. And I was looking for a perfect segue into the Cowboys, so that seems to be as good a segue as I'm ever going to get, mate. So I hope you don't mind me taking this and running with it. What a great win by the Cowboys on the weekend. Congratulations to you and, of course, all the team at North Queensland Cowboys up there, mate. You must be stoked.
Yeah, Jesse, we obviously had a few words on this before we hit record. It's just been jubilation. Euphoric is another word that I and others have been using. Having been at the game on Sunday night in Sydney was just amazing. Obviously, I'm closely tied into the Cowboys, chairman of the Cowboys Leagues Club. And as I pointed out, that's a distinction. It's not the football club. They obviously are the team and the players. And they spend the money, whereas we at the Leagues Club actually make the money through food and alcohol and gaming. Here in the heart of Townsville, we've got a very large league club with 220 gaming machines and just spent $6.5 million renovating it. It's a fantastic facility, and it's the social home of the Cowboys with 27,000 members before we won, probably 30,000-35,000 now by this stage. The Cowboys, the win was just, as I've had texts and emails from all over the country and even the world saying that was the most gripping, amazing game of footy that, you know, anyone's, or grand final even, that they've ever seen. And, you know, there's a lot of business and sport analogies, and I use them all the time. People around here probably get sick of it, but I know where my passions are, and sport is certainly one of them. At the moment, obviously, it's the Cowboys, lots of other sports, and they're just all so similar, as is business. So the parallels and the comparisons and the analogies are just constant. So Paul Green was the new coach 2 years ago, inaugural run as head coach, again backing a bit of an underdog or an untried and a bit untested, although he was assistant coach of the Roosters when they won the grand final the year before. But again, the Cowboys board, you know, picked him as a potential, and he had great traits and qualities and attitude, and his ex-Origin, ex-Cowboys, ex-whoever playing career was good and a real smart head for footy, and had learnt a lot under the Roosters, you know, win. And that year, he brought a whole new approach and a new broom and a new, you know, brushed out a lot of old ways and habits and traditions, and a new breath of fresh air, which again, sometimes you've got to do in a management team or a boss or a CEO or any part of your business, including the dentist sometimes. And then, you know, the belief that the team have had throughout the year. I'm also involved as what they call one of the stockmen, which is a mentoring group of 15 odd towns or businesses, businessmen who, you know, spend a lot of time and effort and attention with the players, talking about life during and after football, because obviously they only have a very limited lifespan to make their money and make their fame and achieve these huge highs, which took 20 years to get. And that is another key point, but sometimes success takes 20 years to build and create and achieve.
The overnight success that took 20 years, you mean?
Absolutely. So many people make that comment of me, and I sort of think, wow, well, that's 25 years of my life I've given to dentistry and hard yards and, you know, putting in the effort and thinking about things. And the Cowboys have just had such an up and down season. We've come from behind so often. And again, a key point there is, you know, when the chips are down or things seem to be going against you, or the times are a bit tough or challenging, or the crown or the filling or the patient you're dealing with is, you know, hard yards and it's just not all working smoothly, whereas other days it does just go smoothly. You've just got to keep going and keep trying. And as we saw on Sunday night at the 79.45 second mark, that's when it was won. Literally, as the hooter rang, as Michael Morgan flicked past to Kyle Felt on that wing, and he almost could have walked over the line. Michael Morgan had done such a good job as a team member, being good at what he does, taking on the line and hitting it up and drawing two or three people in around him so he could flick that pass to an open potential winger who scored.
And that's a really key point, isn't it? Having, you know, you've got in a footy team, like a dental team, really, you've got everyone in their specialist role, and they obviously everyone needs to be able to get along and perform as part of the team. But each person in that role needs to be expert at that particular task that they're undertaking. You know, so, you know, you've got a whole back line of individuals there, but they're all functioning brilliantly individually, but also cohesively, which, you know, clearly won the day.
Yeah. And the other key point in that 30 seconds or a minute was it was chaos. You know, the Bronx were under full attacking and trying. They knew that there was 30 seconds left. JT had gone one way. The defense had come up. He jinked. He turned. He actually did a 360 running around, and everyone was looking in horror thinking, it's a fifth tackle, 20 seconds to go now. And, you know, out of chaos and madness and stress, he saw distance, looking ahead strategically almost. He saw Michael Morgan out wide, hurled a massive pass to him, and Morgo just knew that he was part of that team and he was being relied on, and there was no time left. He had to pull, you know, success out of chaos or success from the jaws of defeat, and just took on the line with faith and confidence and knowing that he'd have someone. Talking to Michael after the game, he said he couldn't see because he was smothered with Broncos players, so he just actually flicked that pass out, that amazing pass, and knowing and hoping and believing that Kyle Felt, his winger, was outside him in the right position and ready to go at full tilt and, you know, cross that line and score that winning try, which you think through that as an analogy in business, and it's just so amazing.
It is phenomenal, isn't it? Hey, Daryl, there's just one last question. I know we're going to have to let you get back to your day gig in a minute, but one last question I'd love to ask you about the Cowboys, and then we'll wrap up. But 2005, difficult year for the Cowboys. And I guess one of the lessons I want to just quickly distill is every team, every business deals with failure at some point or another. Things don't go right. And, you know, I've long held the view that how you deal with failure will determine what successes you have beyond it. How does the footy team, and I guess how does 1300 Smiles by extension, but specifically with the footy team, how did they cope with that grand final loss a decade ago? And what changed? What steeled them? How did they respond? You know, were there any key differences, challenges, changes? What came up in that department?
Ooh, there's a lot to that question too, Jesse. You asked some big multi-barreled ones. A couple of things. I have a firm philosophical view that for every negative or loss or whatever you call it, but a negative. There's an equal and opposite positive. And in fact, in my belief, that positive often is vastly bigger and greater than the negative or the loss that you initially are experiencing. So whenever things go wrong or you lose or things aren't what you expected, just wait, have faith and be patient to some extent, but usually very quickly and circumstantially or otherwise, be it, you know, the grace of God or some other great spirit or whatever you believe, but it is often a rebound positive. So, you know, a loss in the grand final, and again, it was a flick pass from Benji Marshall to the guy they showed it on the grand final day. But again, that's what broke us and lost us the game back then, you know, 10 years ago. In business, yeah, you've got to obviously get over the upset and the disappointment and the grief and the tears and emotion, try and put all that aside. And obviously several days of drinking and drowning sorrows, I think, went on back then that I was involved with and the team and otherwise. I was then, you know, basically getting on with it, rebuilding, refocusing. And unfortunately, they were the Graham Murray days, and Phil sat a quiet toast to Muzza after the grand final win on Sunday night. He's no longer with us, of course, but, you know, he was a great leader, one of the most amazing human and people managers and coaches most of us have ever seen and experienced. He's revered up here, and at his funeral, it was an amazing affair. You know, it was regrouping. It's, you know, getting, you know, retiring off some older players, getting in some new staff or players, so to speak, in the analogies, you know, changing some of the, you know, a lot of it's been high performance and the fitness and the injury prevention and the way they are trained and done. We were, you know, during that then and thereafter, there was talk of overtraining, and the old Billy Johnson was a tough old trainer and, you know, fitness guy, and he just, no air conditioning, you'd run as far as you could and you'd get as hot as you can and you smash and bash the crap out of yourselves, and that's how you trained. And to some extent, fatigue fits in. There's Paul Bowman, who's obviously a legend here in the club. He and his high performance unit have a very different view, and we've had very few injuries this year, which often is the secret, the difference between the top four or five teams is just simply injuries. And the Roosters and the Rabbitohs were classic examples of that this year. So again, if you've got a weakness or a defect or an injury or, you know, emotional or relationship issues in your team, you've got to sort of address them and try and either coach them through it, or worst case scenario, unfortunately, put them on the bench or let them go. So it's not a lot of analogies, but yeah, you've got to, you know, certainly focus on the main game, and that is go back, stick to your knitting, change what you've got to change, but focus on winning that grand final, winning the premiership, you know, being successful in business, and the analogy we're talking, you know, really just keep going. And we talk internally about the 20-mile march. Step by step, it's a long journey, like, you know, my 25 years, and I'm sure there's others who've been doing a lot longer than me. But, you know, every day you've got to do certain things, like step, left, right, and do a lot of the systems and processes and things routinely, every day, the same way, just like cooking a Macca's burger or fries. You know, that's what they do well. They cook gazillions of them every day the same way. And I'm not comparing dentistry to Macca's, but I'm just talking about the business principle of systems and procedures and just doing the basics right, practicing. You know, perfect practice makes perfect, not just practicing. And, you know, pulling a team together around you who have a passion and a vision and a shared goal, which is strategy, to win and succeed and be a part of something bigger and greater. And the euphoria around town at the moment is just mind-boggling. We've got the awards night tonight, which JT and others will obviously clean up again, but the boost, the shot in the arm that Townsville's got at the moment is just mind-blowing. And, of course, the players have just been celebrating all week and are ready to do it again tonight and then head to Vegas to celebrate tomorrow. So you've got to celebrate your wins and your losses and keep, you know, viewing the future in time to come.
Daryl, again, there's just a ton of stuff that I'd love to talk to you about there, because I think we could probably go on with the footy analogies all day. Listen, mate, I would like to just say thank you on behalf of all the listeners and of myself for taking the time out of your day today. There's been so much good oil that's come out of the conversation, and I hope that the listeners are really scribbling notes down there. Do leave us a comment in the notes, you know, at the bottom of the page, so we'd love to hear your feedback. Daryl, thank you on behalf of all the listeners, and, you know, really appreciate your time. look forward to catching up soon, mate. Enjoy the celebrations tonight. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of fun. You know, we'll have to catch up at a footy game soon.
Great, Jesse. My absolute pleasure. And I hope, yeah, there were some gems out of all of that. So thanks to everyone. Bye for now.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.